It's Monday, July 31st, 2006, and you're listening to episode 12 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 2 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan, and we are missing John today, which may be a preview of things to come.
No, John, don't go!
It's going to be a preview of things to come because he's going to be going to Rome soon. I can't remember if we mentioned this in the last podcast, but we have confirmed that Dawn is going to take his slot. Mm-hmm. So we will have a permanent woman, so to speak, on this podcast.
It's slathered all over the forums if we didn't mention
it. Yeah, if you haven't been on the forums, it's all over the place on there. If you haven't been on the forums, forget about that announcement. Just get on there in general, fearthefoot.com. Anyways, with me today we have Chad.
Howdy.
And Adam.
Hi.
We are calling today's episode an inconvenient podcast because it is all about the environment.
Yes.
All we are talking about today is the gaming environment. Let's actually start with that phrase itself, the gaming environment, the place in which you game.
Well, Dan, real quick, before we get into the meat of this, I want to bring up a tangent point here.
Okay.
Wow, 45 seconds in, and here
going
we are.
Straight to a tangent. Something that we talked about a couple podcasts ago is the people who game with kids.
Right.
And we can't really talk about that because none of us have kids.
Right.
Well, I think that's going to change over the next 8 months because Dawn is pregnant.
Say what?
Dawn's pregnant. I'm going to be a father.
Wow. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Gross.
Now, just for the folks at home, that he really has not mentioned this until right now.
Not at all.
That's...
We are just now hearing this for the first time. That is, this is not staged.
I'm going to go throw up.
Adam hates children. Adam
actually, you know what? We might actually have to pause this so I can call Molina because she's like, you know, Dawn's going to get pregnant soon. And I was like, what are you talking about?
Wow.
No, do it right now. The people at home want to hear this. So when did you find out? Well, he's getting his phone out.
I found out about 2 days ago.
Well,
I'm
going to shake your hand across this table now. Folks at home can't see that. But
thank you.
I don't have any bubblegum cigars for you.
Well, Dawn had... She'd been acting strange for a couple days.
You've ruined my life.
What have you done to me?
I had no clue what was going on.
Uh-huh.
And I knew something was going on.
Chad just told me that Dawn is pregnant. Yes, Dawn is pregnant, like with a parasitic child.
It's a son.
I wish we had Skype. If we had Skype, I would have this conversation on the podcast right now.
No, you're not on speakerphone.
Melina, we're calling you on the air.
On the air. Live.
We're still recording the podcast.
Pre-recorded live.
Well, anyway, Dawn had...
We're still recording the podcast.
Sex?
Well, yeah, besides that. No, like I said, she'd been acting strange for a couple days, and
right.
I couldn't tell what was going on. And so finally we went out to dinner. I was just like, what's going on? You know, there's something going on. And she's like, well... I'm like, you're pregnant.
Yes. The official response from Melina is gross. I'm glad their lives are ruined.
Thank you, Melina.
So you're getting a baby, and Adam, you and Melina just got two kittens.
Yep.
I'll stick with my kitten.
They use the litter box.
So back to the podcast.
Well, you know what? We spent 20 minutes deciding what we were going to banter about for 10 minutes. Here we go.
Actually, speaking of cats and gaming, I'm now on my second cat. And the first one that I got, I have this problem where you get a cat and they know they're supposed to use litter box, but sometimes over the first day or two or three you have them, they either don't know which object is the litter box or they're not clear where it is. And I used to have this big white box. It's maybe about a foot by 18 inches by about 2 feet tall. So it's kind of a deep box that I carry on all my gaming notepads and papers and stuff in there. And when I got my first cat several years ago, he disappears in the closet for a little bit, comes out, and it just smells like, you know what?
Nature.
And nature. It smells perfectly natural. And I go in there, and there's this big old kitty loaf sitting there right on top of all these papers and all these notepads.
Excellent.
And let's say that's just an offense he only did once. That was the end of that. My current cat, he really didn't do that for a while he had a thing with the Papasan, which is why we're now on the second cushion on that. But
your current cat likes dice too. I rolled a D20 onto the floor, and that was it. I couldn't touch that D20 for a long time.
Yeah, it's gone.
It just went crazy.
You know, but actually, we're talking about the gaming environment, and I probably should have defined that a little bit better earlier. When I'm talking about the game environment, we're talking about where you game. We're talking about the things around you when you game. We're also talking about the setting in the game. Mm-hmm. Put that on many levels. But really, this kind of does tie into it, because the influence of pets around the game does influence your game. And that's one of the things, is we can't leave dice or miniatures out.
Right.
If we go out to dinner, you have to put them all away, because otherwise there's little kitty paws are going to carry them to every which end of creation.
Like a miniatures model game. We played a Battletech game, I think.
Yeah.
On the floor, we did miniatures rules, and we didn't have a table big enough. So we just played on my living room floor. We moved the furniture out of the way and stuff.
And we still knock stuff over.
Oh, yeah. You can't do that with like a pet or a cat. Run through.
We did that once at my parents' place ages ago. Because I think it was the Battletech Compendium, the softcover one, had a conversion for playing with miniatures without a hex map. Just playing on an open playing field.
Well, I love Battletech, period. I love Battletech. With the miniatures rules, more than I like playing it with the map rules. It's just that it's so, and again, not to take this on tangent, but it is kind of a
game environment,
environment thing, is that it's so much easier to do a model game with a map on tabletop. Everything's right there. It's controlled. You don't have to have all the little model terrain stuff.
I like it too. The problem that I've always had with it is that it's a lot easier to go out and buy a bunch of maps than it is to, number one, buy professional terrain or modeling terrain. Secondly, put it together. And third, if you game anywhere but there, God forbid, to move it.
Yeah. Ugh.
But back when we used to play Battletech in the basement of the hobby shop, I think you were there for a game where we did is like a lance on lance plus some support. And we had this huge ping pong table size table that they had put everything on. They had like mountains, and there was a city. There was a river running through the middle.
Yeah.
And it was really neat, because you're not constrained to hexes. You just pick a direction. And, you paid so many movement to turn so many degrees facing. And
none of the terrain was ours, so we didn't have to clean it up.
Yeah, exactly. We did not set it up. We did not clean it up. We did not have to move it thereafter.
Yep.
But that was great. Mm-hmm. When we did this at my parents' place ages ago, what we did was, I don't even remember where we got them from. I think it was the same hobby shop, but we bought... They were these styrofoam hexes that I guess were about maybe 3 or 4 inches across, maybe a little bigger. Mm-hmm. It was great because you could stack them together to make terrain. So if you wanted a mountain, you could just kind of shove these hexes together in layers.
And whatever.
Yeah, and it was real easy because
like a Lego...
kind of.
Yeah, but imagine it's just interlocked styrofoam hex.
Well, they didn't interlock.
So the flat sides didn't lock, but they...
You could just like rearrange it and create your own.
Yeah, they just came together nice and flush. And we just made it real easy. Like, you know, one hex is one elevation. If you have three of them, what's a three elevation hill? Yeah. And we had measuring tapes we used to measure distance and speed and things like that. Mm-hmm. I've never tried that with anything other than Battletech. For D&D, I mean, we use the square map and all that, but we still use squares and miniatures. Mm-hmm. We don't whip out the measuring tapes and start, you know, if your character can move 30 feet around, that's so many inches. You know, I don't know how exactly you'd convert that, but I'm sure there are people out there that do this. I mean, of course, we do it with strategy games, Warhammer 40K and such. That we more do. But that's actually how the big board got its start.
Yeah.
Was I was in a 40K for a little while, and we needed a 4-foot by 6-foot playing surface. And I went out, look around tables, and it's like all of the tables you buy, and I did not know there was a standard, but apparently there is, that like almost every table in the world is exactly 30 inches wide.
Really?
I have no idea why. But I looked high and low, and almost every table I could find was 30 inches wide. I could not find a 4-foot by 6-foot table anywhere. And so,
is it a pool table, 4-foot by 6-foot?
I don't know. But I didn't want to spend $1,500 on a game. No.
So, oh, why not?
So I went out and bought a 4-foot by 6-foot dry erase board.
Yeah.
Because it was, of course, some people say, why didn't you just go out and get wood? Well, the reason we did the dry erase board is, unlike wood, we could mark things on there. We could color in big.
And erase it.
Yeah. We could mark starting zones and deployment zones and objectives and color
and
water.
Wood is heavy.
And, well, splintery. And,
dry erase board isn't.
Yeah, it's not nearly. I mean, it is heavy, but it's not nearly as heavy as a. That much plywood would have been.
Well, what kind of environment do you like for tabletop games, like standard role-playing game, D&D,
the favorite Shadowrun? Well, let's start with the central fixture of the room, because there actually is a little bit of disagreement about this. For me, I like playing in a casual environment, but and we'll define that here in a second, but around a table. Now, the table doesn't, it does not have to be like chairs pulled up to a dining room table.
Right.
It could just be you're playing sitting on a couch, but there's a coffee table between you. But I like to have a table prominently featured.
I have to have a table. Now, I dislike sitting around the kitchen table and everybody's up against it and that sort of thing.
I have no problem with that. Why does that bother you?
Because there's structure there.
No, because
organization.
I think that a good role-playing game, you should be relaxed. You should be able to sit back. First, my ideal setting for a role-playing game is couches and a coffee table. If people want to get up and act something out, like Adam always does.
Oh, yeah.
Right, yeah. We can't stop him when he starts LARPing.
Yeah, and you can move the coffee table out of the way or whatever.
Right.
But you definitely need a flat surface. People have drinks. People have food. People have their dice, their papers and pencils and stuff to lay it on there. But no, I prefer couches.
Now, does this include, if we're playing Battletech, which requires an enormous amount of table space, do you also like playing that in couches instead of around a large table?
No, the role-playing Mech Warrior, I would definitely want to play around couches. But no, if we're talking tabletop strategy, models, maps, figs, that sort of thing, no, I would definitely rather have the kitchen table. Almost to the point to where you get rid of the chairs or move the chairs back so people
can stand and walk around the table. Yeah. Ideally, for that kind of situation, you want the table to be like in the middle of a big room.
You want a light hanging over it.
Yeah, with a light hanging over it, no walls, and people just walk up to the table and move around it.
Right.
So you like super structure to it.
Only when we're like...
Only model.
It depends on what you're doing. Like, if we're playing the Battletech map game, which requires a huge amount of focus concentration from every single player, you need that uncomfortable structure. But when we're playing D&D, I think the setup we have now, two couches that face each other, the DM sits in one easy chair in the middle, and there's a coffee table, a really low coffee table in the middle.
Yeah. I guess I don't personally care too much either way as long as the table's present. I'm just as okay playing around a big dining room table as I am gaming around a lower table in the coffee room. Let's talk about the room itself.
It has to be eggshell white.
Well, you know, well, jokes aside, that's kind of what I'm getting at. Is,
so you can get more in character, right?
It really draws out my personality.
When you talk about gaming rooms, you know, there are some times where you just take an existing room, decorate it as it is, and you play there.
Right.
In your dining room, your kitchen, whatever. But we've also known people that have dedicated
gaming
rooms where they have gaming-related decorations hanging up.
Their favorite D20 hanging from the wall. That one won me the competition in 96. Never rolled it since.
They always have a...
they have the catalog-ordered melee weapons.
Yeah, they've got the
on the wall.
The TokenMuseumReplica.com sword hanging from the wall.
You know what? I was going to start off by saying I've never played in that environment, but that's not true. We have played in that environment, and you know what? I don't know about that. Those theme rooms.
Do you like it? Do you hate it? Does it not matter to you either way?
I like the practicality of it. I mean, I'm a huge dork. I'm a big gamer. But you know what? I own a little apartment, so I don't have much say in this. But if I owned a big house, I think that I would want the room to be more than just the dork room.
Uh-huh.
You know, because I want to have people over who don't game.
Right.
And they're like...
Well, let's say you're at somebody else's house.
Yeah.
And they have...
Oh, somebody else has fun. That's a problem.
Somebody else has not my problem. Yeah,
I do like gaming in those rooms.
Yeah,
as cheesy,
so
as
practical,
tacky as they are, I really do like gaming in them because the decorations, first of all, they kind of keep me in the mood. Because I look around the room and all I see, growing up, as we were gaming, we knew a lot of artists.
Mm-hmm.
And so we used to always look around. Here was all this art they had done related to our games.
Yeah.
And actually, gaming art's one of the things I want to talk about here today, so I don't want to vault this too much.
Mm-hmm.
But as we looked around, you know, there'd be pictures of our characters or funny scenes from the games or really neat scenes from the games and posters from comic books. And I don't think most places I've been in had the token Cutlery World sword. But
well, I like the idea of it because it's like you're sitting in a chair, you're all set up, and you're like, oh, I need a beer. You reach your arm out to the right, you open the mini fridge, you take out a beer. Oh, man, forgot my dice. Reach your arm out to the left, you grab a handful of dice. Oh, look, there's the miniatures. You turn around, you open up the display case of miniatures, and you start taking them out.
I also feel very relaxed in those environments, in addition to being on topic. I'm not sure why, but if I'm in a gaming room, I just feel so relaxed. Maybe it's just because I'm surrounded by things I like. But
it's because there's a lot less clutter and a lot more focus to the room. Like, in a living room, the living room provides multiple functions. Like, you sit there, you relax there, you watch TV there, you play games there. That's not the focal point of the room. But do you feel more focused because the room is for gaming?
I think so.
I think so, yeah.
Well, let me ask you this. How do you feel? Now, again, my apartment is super tiny. But how do you feel about gaming in my place? Because we sit around the couches. There's the dice bowl there where we have 100 dice in it. And then there's a bookshelf with all the role-playing game books. But then again, there's also my TV and my DVD player, my PlayStation.
It
books,
doesn't bother
magazines.
Me, but I'm going more for, like, psychologically, they tell you sleep less well in a room that isn't your bedroom.
Right.
Because you are focused on sleeping in that room. Mm. Like, you shouldn't do things in your bed that aren't sleeping. Because it ruins the focus of it. And that's kind of what I was getting at. Like, you kind of condition yourself to a certain
right.
point.
I see
of
what you're saying. Right. You don't sleep in the kitchen because
right.
you make food in the kitchen.
You're right. I eat in the
and
kitchen.
And it's impractical. But
the only thing I don't like about your apartment is it eats things.
It eats things.
It eats
I
things.
Thought that you were going to say it's 1,000 degrees.
Well, it is like the surface of the sun.
It
in
is,
there.
Yeah. Adam and I always say that we're going to game at Chad's place in a Speedo with an ice bucket next to us. But so I don't like that either. But no, the thing I was getting at was it seems like if I set something down,
it's gone.
Finding it again is like a 5-minute rummage process.
Well, then you need to roll 2d20.
It's because we have so much stuff.
Favorite place you ever gamed?
The Batcave.
Yeah. We'll have to define what that was, but I got to agree with you. That was my number one place to game. Before we explain the Batcave, Adam, what was the best place you've ever gamed?
I think your old place, Chad.
Yeah.
Your townhome. It was a lot of space.
Oh, so much space. So expensive, but so much space, yeah.
The Batcave, all right, in our golden age of gaming, this was right as we were graduating high school, just starting college. Most of us did not work jobs. We had huge amounts of free time on our hand.
Yeah.
Because even if you're taking a 12 or 18 credit hour course in college and not flunking out or skipping your classes, it still typically does not take up all that much of your time.
Oh, yeah, especially if you don't have jobs.
Yeah, and so we used to just game all the freaking time, morning, noon, and night, 2, 3, 4 days a week. There was a friend we had who pretty much had taken over the entire basement.
He had a finished basement.
Yeah, he had a finished basement.
His parents' house.
And he had pretty much just taken it over.
Yeah.
And it was just filled with his stuff.
Comic books. Like, he owned a comic book shop for a short time, and he collected comic books. Had thousands of them. Comic books in the white boxes stacked everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, everywhere.
Posters, comic book posters, everywhere.
Stand-ups of comic book characters or movie stars.
Tons and tons of VHS tapes of pirated anime.
Yeah, he was also an artist, and so there was art everywhere. Yeah. And this whole place, I mean, just it was a huge amount of space. So you had this great big open area if you wanted to do some improv RP.
Mm-hmm.
Off to one side, there was a ring of, like, couches and easy chairs around a table.
Around the table. Well, that was the neat thing about the table. The table was low, but it wasn't a coffee table. It was a
full-size table.
A full-size table. Around it didn't have chairs, like folding chairs or dining room chairs. It had love seats and couches. So you had, like, the best of both worlds.
Had this massive chalice of dice on it, bookcases nearby with all the game filing cabinets where we would keep all the character sheets and such. Yep. And that was the place. It was huge. It was in theme. It was secluded. It had everything you needed. That was probably the best place for gaming I have ever seen.
And we called it the Batcave. Well,
clearly, it earned its title.
Well, he had a huge Batman flag.
Yeah, that's right. It was a Batman flag. Sectioning off part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Batman is also just a pimp. And
that, well, yes.
That figures into the picture there as well. The negative of the Batcave is some of the other people there. Mm-hmm. We talked about this as a game killer last time. We always rude. Every few minutes, this loud banging knock on the door, followed by a string of profanities and a keep it down.
Yeah.
And that figures into the gaming environment, the other people there.
Right.
And I don't think
What do you do about that? Like, say you are gaming in somebody else's house, and there is somebody there who's not gaming, and they generally do not like the fact that there is a gaming group there and are doing things to disrupt it.
Right.
What do you... What advice can we give people on that?
Well, because I think now you're almost crossing out of Fear the Boot and into Dear Abby.
Yeah.
It's really a social thing. It's just you've got to solve the problem. You know, mm-hmm. if you've got a sibling, if you're younger and you've got a sibling who's being a jackass, you need to take it up with mom or dad.
Take him out back and beat him around a little bit.
Spoken from the only child.
That's right.
He just doesn't understand how it works.
I don't. I really don't.
If the problem is mom or dad, you just got to find out what it is they want out of you and what kind of compromises mm-hmm. and peace treaties you can make there.
That's a big political thing. I remember with you, it was a political thing.
Yeah, it was. We had to pick certain games and
certain days
and do it in certain ways. And if that's not the issue, if it's something else, like your wife just can't stand all your friends being around or your whatever, then I don't know what to tell you outside to go somewhere else.
Yeah, that's more of the common problem that I think people our age would have is that you have a spouse who isn't down with gaming.
You know, I haven't seen this in a long time, but we used to know people that for their games would rent cheap hotel rooms. Like, what?
No way.
Like, locally. If you had a game and your parents didn't want you around or your spouse didn't want you around or whatever, they would just drop some small amount of money, get a room at a Motel 6, wouldn't even stay there. They just go in there, game for the night, and then when they're done, leave and check out.
You can leave all of your food trash there and everything.
And it's of course a ridiculous waste of money.
Yeah.
But let's say you have a gaming group of like five people.
Well, and let's say if you only game once a month.
Yeah, and if you've got a game group of like five people.
Six people.
Yeah.
$5 each.
$10 a piece.
That's not a bad
actually,
idea.
That's not.
We should do that
so
now.
Crazy, yeah.
Even though we have our own places, we should do it now. Now here, Carla, as she said in the last podcast, she really does not game much. So actually last night, she was nagging me that she wants me to start a Star Trek game soon. She really wants to play Star Trek again. Apparently, watching TNG on G4 is getting her in that mood or whatever.
Well, it's getting her in
the mood. The one we care most about. The gaming mood.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
And
kinky.
But even though she doesn't typically game, she's supportive of the hobby. Mm-hmm. She loves hearing the story unfold, the plots unfold, and she doesn't insert herself in it. I mean, she just tends to do her own things while we're gaming. That's a pretty good arrangement. Doesn't mm-hmm. really cause me any problems. This is also kind of related to gaming environment. People eating while gaming. And by eating, I'm not talking about they're grabbing a few handfuls of
Doritos.
Or Mountain Dew or whatever. I'm talking about the bastard who's got to have a three-piece meal. They've got a roast chicken.
Yeah, we're sitting at the table with him.
A full pizza. Hold on, guys. Stop combat.
Eat.
I got to cook. Ding. The pizza's done.
I like to cook.
Drives. Like to eat.
Yeah, I do. I'm a fat bastard.
You know what? This and a topic we're going to talk about later. I am very fiery about.
Go, fire.
I'm the guy
Rage.
Who loves the clean, pristine character sheet. It's a marvel. You pick it up with gloves and tongs because you don't want anything to get on it. And then some fat bastard at the table looking at Chad. Oh, man, look, I got salsa. And salsa is everywhere. Salsa's on the TV, on the walls, on the table. You're picking up dice and be like, wait a minute. That's not a die. That's a chopped tomato from your salsa. And you roll it at him. Oh, I hate that.
See, for me, it's not the mess. It's the interruption. Because if someone's snacking, as gamers tend to do, it doesn't bother me. But if someone has to interrupt the game to cook food, to get food out of the oven, to cut the pizza up, it's continuously shoving big mouthfuls of food in their mouth, like, dry is a huge
pet
peeve of mine. So my rule when I'm GMing is if you've got to eat a full-blown meal, I'm cool with that. I really am. People got to eat. But I stop the game. It's like, everyone pause. We're going to take a 20-minute break so Porky here can make and eat his pizza.
Now you guys are just hurting my feelings.
Oh, I'm not. I haven't been game with you long enough. It's not you that I have this beef with.
Oh, no, it's you I have this beef with. No one else at the table eats but you.
Yeah. Everybody is like 98 pounds, and I'm some 400-pound bastard, and I just grab the players next to me arm and start chewing.
You're too fat to get out of your chair, so we have to forklift you into the kitchen, and that's really distracting to the game.
And I got something I need to get up here and get, just have you guys describe over the mics for listeners at home. So what is the other subject you have all kinds of rage about? Because I just need to set you off and walk away for a minute.
I think it's on the list. Do you want to get to there now?
You tell me.
List? Wait, we don't have a list. This is totally spontaneous.
I think it's the next one down on the list, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, you're right. It is the next
All
one
right.
on this. All right. I'll just announce it. Using music while gaming.
I like it.
I hate it. Listen. They've done studies. Mm-hmm. Your brain, when you hear music, your brain shuts everything else out and focuses on the music. A non-ADD player having to deal with already the short attention spans at the table, namely from the ADD players.
I don't know what you're talking about.
And I'm giving you the squinty eye. Your music
I don't know what
is
you're
not
talking
helping the situation. Because then you start, yeah, and the castle.
I mean,
what?
The spaceship.
What castle? What spaceship? We were in the forest.
Now
what
you're
are you talking
dungeon.
About? No, but Johnny Cash is on. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I love
Johnny
the Man
Cash,
in Black.
The man.
But the Man in Black is not playing the role-playing game with us.
You know what? He's playing it up in heaven.
He's
looking
watching
down
us
on
from
us.
Heaven. He's watching us because he doesn't want to interrupt because that would be rude.
All right. I can't find it, so maybe I'll find this some other time. But what I was looking for was we used to play plating games, specifically Robotech. One of the things about role-playing books in general is they are food attractants. If you're ever hungry, you can just drive past a fast food restaurant, hold an RPG book out the window, and it will attract a complete meal for you.
Yes.
For example, we were once gaming a Star Trek game, and we had a big canister of Hungry Jack biscuits. And we put these
I love biscuits.
We put this canister of biscuits next to a bunch of RPG books. As we're gaming along doing this, all of a sudden, boom! And we all just stop. This gunshot-like noise tears through the room, and we look over, and the biscuits were put next to a bunch of RPG books,
yes.
And they just exploded, and biscuit was blown all over them.
Nothing else.
Yeah, nothing else. Well, when we were gaming Robotech, Chad was eating a pizza over a Robotech book. Now, the slice of pizza did not go anywhere. The entirety of the pizza went face down, dead center on the Robotech book. So the book looks normal. You flip along, and then you come to these two pages.
It's the pizza page.
That are both, inside and out, bright pink from where this Totino's pizza just face down into them.
Hey, a man's got to eat.
So I'll have to see if I can find this for at least for the other hosts later. And if I find it, maybe I'll scan it, put it up on the website.
Of course, it might stick to your printer.
Of course, we say this about a lot of things, like the John picture, and we never find him. It never happens. But.
Yeah.
Well, there was a whole rigmarole. Oh, I still have that picture.
It was stolen. Did you read my post?
No.
Okay.
All right.
For anybody who doesn't read the forums, last podcast, or in one of the bonus ones, John talked about a con picture where he was checking out some chick's Klingon chick's rack. And we have a picture of him just like laser eyeing her
right.
large tracts of land. And I had that picture. It was in a photo album.
Time out. You realize you just made the first Monty Python joke of this entire podcast. I've had people write me and say, you know what I really like about your podcast? You don't fill it with Star Wars and Monty Python quotes. And I used to be able to take a high ground there and say, why, yes, you're right. This is dignified masterpiece theater.
They
show this podcast on PBS. We don't do things like that. But anyways, all right.
What was the joke? Because I've
Huge
only seen Holy
land.
Grail.
He said,
it's in Holy Grail.
He called
long
her,
ago, I guess I saw Holy Grail.
He just called her knockers huge tracts of land. I'm sorry, continue. So this picture got stolen by a bunch
of Dan,
goblins.
Do you like Monty Python or do you hate Monty Python?
I like boobs. I mean,
so, okay, he's dodging the question.
The tangent, here we go.
I
All right,
like
so where
Monty
this,
Python.
Let's start backing ourselves out of tangents until we reach gaming music again.
This is multi-layered.
This is like
hole that we've dug ourselves into.
This is like an onion we must peel open.
No, we need to peel back closed. And
we were talking about.
Let's back up. Where did the picture go? Quickly.
The picture was stolen. Flipped open my book. There are pictures of John getting arrested at the con.
And that one picture's missing.
Right there, it's even labeled. And it's gone. Somebody stole it.
Are you sure it's stolen, not just loaned out and never seen again?
Well, that's the same thing as stealing.
Okay. Closing the onion. If you give it to somebody, forget. That's theft.
Okay.
Closing that layer of the onion, moving back to gaming music. Adam, I am with you. For some games, I can handle, for some limited games, I can handle mood music in the background. We played a D20 Star Wars game. We were playing Imperial characters, and we had the soundtrack to the second movie, Empire Strikes Back, playing in the background, and it worked really well. It was all really low symphonic music. Of course, we just all got our necks all ruffled up every time the Imperial March came on. But for the most part, if there's music in the background, exact same problem as you, all I hear is the music.
Here's my problem with it. I like music during a game, but you can't do it. One of the reasons is you're playing Imperial characters in a Star Wars game, you got the soundtrack going, and it's doing the Imperial March, and everybody's getting into characters, then it switches tracks to the Ewok theme. Yeah, suddenly that mood you just built up is gone, and you might as well just stop the game. Another problem is that as a game master, you put music to tracks and, you know, you have it hit on certain parts. A scene in a role-playing game doesn't last 3 minutes. You play for 10 hours, whatever. And, you know, you'd have to keep looping that track. So there you are with a remote and your stereo trying to time these points, and it just...
what people are typically trying to recreate is great moments on film. And the thing about great moments on film is you can pick when the song starts, you can creatively edit to make the song last exactly as long as the scene, you can tie major events to great big flourishes in the music. You can't do that in an RPG.
I think that you can do, like, ambient or classical music, or maybe ambient music, low and in the background. Just kind of like a background mood thing. In my group, it doesn't work because too many people have a problem with that. Eyeing Adam.
There are too many distractions that are on the table to begin with, and that is just an additional one that we should eliminate.
Right. For me, it's not that big of a deal, whether we have it or not. I mean, it's not like I must have my music. Even though
I must not have my music.
For Adam, it's a big deal, so it's dropped. Although I do slide an occasional Johnny Cash Gettysburg Address speech in there, and that gets everybody going.
It's at the beginning, though.
Yeah.
That's a good opener.
You know, you're playing a sci-fi game, Johnny Cash doing the Gettysburg Address.
I am all about the beginning, before the game, focusing all music. Right.
Every gaming group.
I can see that. Well, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I can see that as, like, the intro. You know how... when a game, a lot of times game masters run a game, they open it up and they're like, they set the scene and, you know, the characters aren't doing anything because he's presenting it to you. I could see running a track.
An overture?
Yeah, like an overture type thing, because you know when to start it, that you can do it with the tension building, and then it comes to an end and then you turn it off and then you go into your game.
That'd be a really cool idea if you wrote the entire session based on things that happened in a song and you played at the beginning to kind of foreshadow what would happen throughout the session. That'd be kind of cool.
Yeah. If you had the time for that.
All right, moving on.
I actually know someone that did that, but, you know, my mind is blank and I can't give you any details. But he made a campaign that was based on the implied themes of an album. And
that's a cool concept.
It's a cool concept. It was so long ago.
I don't know about the execution.
All I can tell you is we didn't complete it. I have no idea how it would have turned out. We just, other things came up and distracted us. We never finished the game. But what I was starting to say, actually talking about your Johnny Cash Gettysburg Address.
Oh, Johnny Cash,
I
love
it. Every gaming group that is worth its weight in salt, unless you are just filled with people that have absolutely no personality, has stupid traditions that draw from, and this is relevant because they draw from the gaming environment, things like playing the Johnny Cash Gettysburg Address, the Battletech prayer that we say.
Yeah, let's not do
the Battletech prayer, but the composer bus.
Yeah, the composer bus.
My dad is a professional composer, professional musician. He had for many years this display case in our dining room that had all of these white busts of various composers.
Yeah.
And I don't know how it got started, but somehow everyone got assigned a composer bust that had to be in front of them, and there was always a fight over Chopin or something like that. I don't
Oh, Mozart again.
have you guys in the years that what are some of those traditions?
Well, we have the James, where the spirit of James Brown, who's dead and in heaven, watches over our friend Phil
because
he has outrageously good luck, and he James it. He channels James Brown. He rolls the die right when they're about to land. He does this. Only, you know, mine really sucks. He does a really, really good James Brown impression.
He does channel James Brown.
He does channel the dead spirit of
James
Brown.
And by the way, for anyone that's going to write in and try and correct us, James Brown really is dead. His body just hasn't finished working out the funk yet.
That's right.
He's reanimated by the funk.
That's why he's the hardest working man in showbiz.
Right.
I mean,
once he finishes working out that last groove, he'll fall over.
That's right. And he'll turn into ash. He'll just blow away. I think that every gaming group who's been around for a while and has a lot of fun with the games should come up with good traditions. It's not something that you could sit down and say, well, we need a tradition.
Yeah, we need a tradition. I think that's a bad idea. But I think that the traditions are a great thing.
Yeah.
It gives a great group unity.
Yeah, esprit de corps, something you laugh about and joke about. And it's something that when you're telling, you're boring people with gaming stories at parties, you can also spin in your little inside jokes, and then people really have no idea what
you're
talking
about. And even the ones that aren't so super inside, no one can understand them. They are funny usually, but they are so amazingly dorky that you will... We here at Fear the Boot are embarrassed for you if you go to parties and tell other people.
You know what I would like to do? I cannot believe that we would be the only ones who would have like a gaming tradition like that.
Right.
I want to hear what some other people's are.
Yeah, send those into us.
Yeah, email them to us, audio us, put them on our forums, and we'll pick out the craziest one, and we'll read it on the air.
Impromptu contest. I like it.
Yeah, feartheboot.com. If we get enough of these, I mean, we could probably devote a portion of the next show to just reading some of the really good ones.
Bonus episode, dude. Oh, my God.
So, yeah, if you've got those, send those in. I'd love to hear those.
This is why we need Fear the Boot t-shirts, so we could do, like, rewards for these contests.
We have a Fear the Boot t-shirt. It's just
not physically.
No, I've ordered one.
They're coming?
Well, I ordered one because since we're going to wear the Fear the Boot shirts to Gen Con and later Archon.
Please not white.
No, it's ash gray.
Okay.
Since we're going to wear shirts to Gen Con and Archon, I ordered one just to make sure they print okay. And if they print okay, I was going to order a couple for each of us so we're not wearing the same shirt for like 4 days in a row.
Ooh,
but
soap.
It looks like these are coming out okay. I have no problem using these as contest rewards.
Used
prizes.
Ones, too.
Yeah, used ones.
This is the four-day-old Gen Con one.
This has actual Adam sweat on it.
Yep.
Yeah, I will love it.
Gross. Mine is salsa.
We can eBay these things for like $1,000 to strange people. Now, in our past couple of shows, we've had some great banter, but we've been a little light on the advice.
Yep.
So today we got...
So today is Fear the Dating Advice.
Right. All we're going to do is dating advice for the next half an hour. But we do have some hella tight advice to give today.
I cannot believe you just said that.
Well, I can't believe I just said it for two reasons. Number one, nobody should say hella tight. At least nobody who's male and over the age of 12 should say hella tight. And
never in the context of gaming advice.
And number two, of course, now that I set this up, this is going to be a massive flop.
Oh, I can't wait.
All right, so let's get it going. Let's talk about building description for setting within the game. We've talked about the environment outside of the game, but honestly, it's funny to talk about. It's just personal preference. There's no right or wrong way to have a gaming environment. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe there's wrong, but there is no right.
Well, there's what works and what doesn't.
That's what I meant by there may be a wrong, but really no particular right.
I think gaming in a car would be a wrong way.
Unless you're LARPing in the scene.
Oh, come on. Setting the scene.
I get to be the driver.
That'd be
great.
But
you can't drive a stick. Yo, my character can.
Yeah, well, the player just dropped my transmission out on the freaking interstate. We're going to have to LARP a lawsuit now. Quick, Bill, run down to AAA. We need to LARP an insurance claim. I wonder if anyone has ever LARPed something. It's like, my character's a snowplow driver. So they actually go out and get a job as a snowplow driver just so they have the...
Or ride with a snowplow driver.
Yeah, just so they have the props. It's like, we're LARPing today, and he drives a snowplow.
Yeah, I'm playing a paramedic.
Is LARPing
going to
become the new Shadowrun?
Maybe. Not. No. I mean, Wang.
Good, because we should never talk about it again.
All right, so the advice for today. Now we've talked about what goes on outside of the game. Inside of the game, when you are a game master describing setting, we want to offer some advice for doing it well. Setting is one of those things that I think is possibly the most overlooked thing in gaming, that people tend to think a fair amount about their NPCs, a lot about their plot, but they don't tend to think much about setting. It's just kind of like, well, here's the setup just so you know where the bad guys are and where the lever is you need to pull, and they move on. They don't really attempt to draw you in, to build emotion, etc. And just think of good books you've read where setting made a huge difference because it sets an emotion to the place. In fact, in the ladies' podcast, Melina talked about how one of her most memorable gaming moments was when you, Chad, set the setting, just the description of what was going on for a particular thing that involves zombies and ash falling from the sky. And I have no idea what she was talking about because I wasn't there for that game. But nonetheless.
It was a great story. Maybe we'll do a bonus episode about it.
Just that one moment.
Yeah, just that one 45
moment. 45-minute gaming story bonus episode.
All right. So first of all, for building setting, I think we just talked about why it's important. It sets emotion. And as I said just a second ago, it also does give you an order of positions and things. So you know where the good guys are, where the bad guys are, where the uninformed and uninvolved are. Let's start with this. What is the line between too little description and too much description? Because I started off by saying that I think most game masters tend to blow past it as just something's in the way.
Right.
But I know you can, and I'm sure I've heard someone before do too much. So what's the line there? When have you crossed from too little to too much?
The too little is...
Too little is really easy to define.
Yeah.
You're in the town.
You walk into the castle. Start role-playing. And you know what? I'm guilty of that, too, because... And there comes a point when you should do that, because you've described the castle. People know what the castle is. They're going to the castle to role-play or to fight or to do whatever.
They've been in the castle hundreds of times
before. Exactly. And I think that one of the ways that you can go too far is you continually describe a place where they've already been and they know what it looks like. Another way you go too far is that I believe in heavy setting. I believe in really laying out what the characters see and that sort of thing. And I've developed over the years, like, I think I used to do too much. You have to give them enough for their imaginations to work with, but you don't want to manhandle their imagination.
Right.
You can manhandle their imaginations two ways. You can go down to every single little detail of describing every single little crack in the walls or stuff, or you could just lay it on too thick. You know, you describe the tapestries and you describe this and you try, and your description, while good and informative, takes 30 minutes.
Right. I would put it in the measure of two things. I think too little or too much can be measured by whether you accomplished or overaccomplished the following two things. Number one, setting the necessary elements of the scene. Mm-hmm. A lever they have to interact with, a king they need to talk to, things that are going to act. The second thing, and this is probably the one I want to develop a little more, because the first one we talked about a couple times now. The second thing is setting an emotion or an emotive aspect to the scene. And this is something that I think a lot of game masters miss. You're in the keep. Mm-hmm. There's a red carpet on the floor. The walls are gray. There's four torches here. You think one of them is from this particular land.
Oh, my God.
Drone on ad nauseum for 21 minutes.
And there is no emotion to it. You don't get a sense that this is a creepy castle. Right. This is a noble castle. This is an austere castle.
No, it's a castle with four boring torches.
Yeah, with four boring torches.
That torch on the left is from the northern kingdoms. Yes. And there they use good wood for their torches.
Oh, my God, I'm going to punch you right now.
You've gone too far. If, on the one hand, you are offering all kinds of detail in the scene regarding things that have nothing to do with the action of the moment. I don't just mean a couple things. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you're just telling them every stupid little crack in the wall, whatever. And on the other hand, if you have given them so much description and emotion that you're now just force-feeding them how they should respond to the scene.
Right.
Yeah. You really, what you're trying to accomplish is you're setting an environment in which they can interact with it, not interact with it for them.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, Adam, if they want to know more detail about the room, they'll ask. I look around the room. What else do I see? Well, what are you looking for?
Yeah.
Are you looking for anything specific?
And that's another negotiation thing about setting, that sometimes players want to know more than you're either willing to tell them, or they want to know more than what isn't actually there in the setting. Because I've had it where they've entered a room and I've described the room, and they're like, well, what's this? Well, it's a table. Well, what's on the table?
Magic table. I don't know what to do with it.
Well, there's a couple papers. Papers? What's written on the papers?
Yeah.
Oh, you know, there's a map and there's a memo. Oh, I read the memo. You read the memo?
Yeah, what's in the memo? Get in the other room! Get in the other room!
Let me save you. Let me offer some player advice here. Players, while you are playing the game, if you ask the game master about something in the environment, and his response is, and he looks vaguely to the left, there's nothing of importance there. Don't worry about it. You will find nothing of plot significance there. Let's give the folks something they can take home. Because we've offered this kind of...
Bacon.
Toaster.
Fear the Boot toasters.
Oh, my God.
Greatest marketing device ever.
But we have talked about how, you know, kind of vaguely what it means to strike that balance between too little and too much. But let's try to be a little more detailed so people actually have some kind of usable advice. And I came up with a couple little things here that I think will help you to learn what that artistic balance is between too little setting, too much setting, or the wrong kind of setting description. And advice number one is let's go with other places where people are forced to use the English language to describe setting, namely books. Let's talk about some authors that did a great job describing setting. One of my favorite authors in general, and I think he did a great job with setting, is C.S. Lewis. And I like the way he did it because there was a couple things he was really good at. First of all, he was a lingual minimalist. He used very few words to describe things, but he picked his words so carefully that the descriptions were very vivid.
Right.
And secondly, he left a certain opening in the description to where the listener, or in this case the reader, would insert themselves into it. For example, he might say, well, there was a roast duck, and there were seasoned vegetables, and all the other things you would expect at a feast like this. Well, what are the other things you would expect? You immediately conjure in your mind, oh, it's that one great food item that my mom or grandma used to always make. I know that's there.
That's the thing, as a DM, it took me a while to learn this, is give the player's imagination something to work with. I can't stress how important this is. And it's a fine balance. It's just not, well, I just describe two things and leave the rest. When I hear my players talk about things that happened in one of my games that I ran, every time they do, when I do a good job, they describe things that I didn't tell them. They always... things that come up in their minds that their imagination were allowed to run with that would make it really, really good. And they're talking about it, and I'm like, you know, I never said that. But I don't tell them that. Because I don't want to ruin the memory of it for them.
Yeah. You jerk have been lying to me for years. Leave this room.
I typically only correct if they misconstrue something I said, but that's a whole different issue.
I let them misconstrue. And history is volatile. So, you know, well, getting back to the authors, and Adam's going to gush over this one. I think one of the best authors I've ever read for setting is Douglas Adams. No, I'm kidding. It's Stephen King.
Yeah, I know.
No, Stephen King, I'm not...
He lays it on thick, though.
Yeah, he is not a minimalist. And he lay... not as much as the guy who does the Redwall series. But I'll get into that in a minute. Stephen King lays it on thick, and he fills in all the details, and it's so good, and the prose are good, so you don't mind reading all that details. You are there. He describes a airport waiting lounge where this vampire went nuts and ripped all these people apart, and I am standing in this lounge looking at all this gore.
Right.
Even if you don't like the way his stories go, you have to... his technical merit.
Yes. Yeah. Like, Adam's a huge fan of the Gunslinger series, and I don't care for him.
Yeah, it's because you have no taste. I'm sorry. Continue.
They're good. They're really good. I just don't like what he is doing with the story. But, yeah, the prose are excellent. And it's just a description. Now, on the other end of it...
Yeah, let's talk about some bad setting.
The guy who does the Redwall series, I don't remember his name offhandedly, and I'm sure... tons of people do, and I know Dawn listens to this, and she likes the series. Children's books, it's about mice, and it's medieval sort of Secrets of Nim thing, only not as weird.
Well, the book Secrets of Nim
was weird, yeah.
Well,
the cartoon was
It was weird. Less weird, because there was no magic. It was all just devices and things like that, but it was going on.
This one
huge
is,
tangent.
Yeah, this one is like a medieval fantasy where you have mice and rats and stuff as the characters, and they dress up in clothes and whatnot. But this guy, I tried reading one of his books, and man... he described a feast, 5 pages of food. At the end of it, I was like, this guy's starving. I want to mail him some food.
You know, someone else I thought did a... just real quick, one other good author before I give you some what I think are some of the bad authors.
Mm-hmm.
What is the name of the lady that wrote A Wrinkle in Time? I'm blanking out. It's the type of thing I knew before. I knew
I have
before
them
the podcast.
Sitting on my
I have
shelf
the book
at home.
Too.
Yeah, I knew before the podcast. I'll know it the minute I turn the mics off. But anyways, she does a great job with setting. She's another
Ursula
one.
Ursula K. Le Guin.
No. I don't know.
Did you just say first name that popped into your
mind?
No.
Okay.
Look it up.
We're gonna look it up.
All right, we're gonna look it up while I keep talking. But so excuse the key typing in the background. She does a great job with setting. Now, some people I thought did very poor jobs with setting, and let me tell you why on each of them. First of all was Michael Crichton in his earlier days. I just read Andromeda Strain not too long ago.
If you like that, you should read Eaters of the Dead.
It was a neat story idea, but typically when he described setting, it was dry, it was emotionless. Everything he talked about, it's Madeline L'Engle.
Ursula K. Le Guin, it is not.
Yeah, it's Madeline L'Engle. But anyway, when Crichton describes these settings, it really struck me more as he's first of all talking about things that are significant to him, not to me. Mm-hmm. And secondly, I almost feel like at times he's just kind of trying to show off the amount of research he did.
Is that the new ones or the old ones?
This was an old book.
No, Drama Strain's old.
Yeah, no, I know that. It's from the 70s. But are you saying that the Michael Crichton modern stuff is like that, or his old stuff is like that?
I've read like Jurassic Park and such, but I don't remember it that well. Mm-hmm. So
Timeline was like that. He would just go on for pages about, they send people back in time about the technology, and it was like, oh, dude.
Arthur C. Clarke.
Oh, God, Arthur C. Clarke.
Really bad like that. Yes. Terrible setting.
Yes.
He's long where he needs to be short, and shorter where he needs to be long.
And his characters are non-existent.
Right.
It's Joe. And that's the extent of the character.
I just read...
You would love it.
I love him. I love him already.
Several years ago, I read 3001, the conclusion of the Space Odyssey series.
How you made it through those.
And, you know, he'd talk about a spaceship or something like that, and he just go on and on and on about
dry
technical stuff. Then in the middle of it, he's got this scene where they're in the middle of a space station or something like that, and they had this huge open area. It had, like, all these exotic plants growing in it, and they had, like, this genetically engineered dragon that lived in there, and there was, like, this chick that was kind of riding around. No description. It's like, yeah, there's this big, huge room with exotic plants, dragon, da-da-da-da-da, back to the plot. It's like, what?
Bring me dragon!
Yeah, it's like, yeah, I mean, it was such a bizarre concept. He could have spent two pages on it. I'd have been okay with it, but it's like...
Well, that was like in 2000.
But the insulated hose on the next page, ooh, that got the whole chapter.
Well, that was like in 2000. The movie was about this... The good part of the movie was about the drama, the murder, drama, mystery thing between Hal and the other astronauts and killing them and stuff. In the book, it got two pages.
Yeah.
Two pages, and it was like, and the book was so dry.
Well, of course, I mean, the movie also had a whole lot of things spinning to the Blue Danube.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
That's a problem with Stanley Kubrick. That's nothing about Arthur C. Clarke.
Yeah.
Well, there's some other bad authors. But not bad authors, bad description, bad setting authors.
Settings and stuff. I don't know. I'm reading a lot of biographies right now. So
not too much setting in those.
No setting at all, really.
Okay, we'll move on from that. Second.
Adam, do you know
the last two books I read were Oracle Database Administration books.
Terrible setting.
Terrible setting.
They gave no setting whatsoever.
When you're in the shared pool, this variable.
Stop. What does a shared pool look like?
What's the variable's motivation?
Can I get a sense of ethnicity or nationality off the variable?
Well, the bind variable has a colon in front of it. That's kind of a unique identifier.
That's a strange alien creature. His colon is out front.
Wow.
All right, I had something else as a suggestion for developing good setting. And this is something that's actually kind of a suggestion that they use for authors, but I think this would work just as well for game masters, which is be a little more conscientious of the setting around you. For example, if you're sitting in class or at work and there's some guy next to you, pretend for a moment you're in front of an audience recounting the story. How would you describe him? Well, he was a balding man with a hawkish nose and this look in his eyes that said he knew far more than he was willing to tell. You know, don't like...
Sweaty-toothed.
Sweaty.
From Dead Poets Society. What it is in Dead Poets Society, the guy's like, I can't.
Tangent.
No, the guy's like, I can't do poetry. I can't think of things like that. And so Robin Williams' character says, look at the picture of the guy. And the guy like glances at it for a second. Robin Williams grabs him and puts his hands over his eyes. Now describe him. And is like putting him into a high pressure situation. And he's just like, he's a sweaty, he's this and that. And he's a sweaty toothed old man. And he's like, a sweaty toothed old man. That's great.
All you just did there was you knocked this show on a tangent. You gave me a horrible flashback to too many high school English classes. Which is when that movie came out, all the more in love with it. But anyway.
I enjoyed that movie.
When you're moving back, stepping away from that tumor, when you're sitting there.
It's not the tumor.
Get to the
When you are
on.
Sitting there, look at the scenes around you and think for a moment how you would describe them. If you're sitting there and there's a really beautiful sunset in front of you, or even it's not, it's a boring drive home staring into the concrete jungle of the city you live in. Look at that for a second and think about how you would describe it. And it's a sense of practice because there's no pressure. There's nobody in front of you. If you're like, well, it's a gray street and there's a lot of tall buildings and there's some awnings and people walking around. Okay, you've just come up with a crappy setting.
Yeah.
Erase, start over.
You know what I had a problem with one time is that we tried to run a
post-apocalyptic
survival sort of game, plague wiped out everything, blah, blah, blah. We set it in St. Louis. Well, we're from St. Louis. We live in St. Louis. We've been all over St. Louis. But I played St. Louis like it was destroyed, right? Mm-hmm. And then like an earthquake had hit. It was ravaged and stuff. I couldn't build a setting there to save my life because I have never been in contact with that sort of ravagedness and destructiveness. And now I guess some people would say, oh, well, then you can't run a game about spaceships like right. Star Trek. Well, the thing is, I've seen Star Trek and I've seen like movies and stuff like that before. It was just so hard for me to build that setting because I was so disconnected.
There's two pieces of advice I would give for that. First of all, is think more about it. Mm-hmm. Just like if you sit down at a game and your mind blanks, you have no plot. I would say you didn't think enough about your plot walking into it.
Well,
and similarly,
screw you, jerk.
I'm not getting. I'm talking.
Yeah, you Caribbean jerk.
I'm not talking about the people who can improv. You can improv. That's fine. But I'd say the same thing about setting. If you walk into a game and all you can give in terms of setting description is nothing. Or this really dry, meandering, pointless stuff, you probably didn't think enough about setting before you began. The second thing I would say is if you need some kind of a context on it, get a context.
Yeah.
Now, also living in St. Louis, for those who don't know much about St. Louis City is a relatively small area that has a not all that big of a population.
The city proper is very small.
The metro area, the county surrounding St. Louis is where all the economy and people, it's like downtown's like 200,000 or 300,000, but the county's like a 1.5 or 2 million people or something like that. But the thing about downtown is being largely an abandoned industrial city left over from the 1800s. Quite frankly, there are a lot of streets in that city that look like post-nuke wasteland. In fact, they've shot post-nuke wasteland movies in St. Louis for that reason.
Escape from New York, a small part of that, the scene where they go and box and that sort of stuff, was filmed in Union Station. Not the whole movie was not filmed in downtown. But
if you need a context for that, look either in the world around you or the popular fiction, like movies and such, and find something to contest it. In our case for post-nuke, they say drive downtown to some of these crappy neighborhoods. And
don't get out of your car.
You don't get out of your car. But
just take pictures and drive away quick.
But, you know, think for a second, how would I describe the scene? Or if you're doing a space station, okay, you can't do a space station. But hop on Google Images.
You can, call us.
Yeah, if you can, we would love to do Fear the Boot in space.
Yes.
Ooh, episode 100, there's the
Fear the Vacuum.
You can just hop on Google Images.
Yeah.
Type in space station or space station sci-fi art or something like that.
Like,
look for pictures of space stations you like and say, okay, if this was real, how would I describe it?
Yeah, like with this Ravage Zone thing, like I could have done like earthquake zones in L.A. when it got flattened by that earthquake.
Yeah, Hurricane Katrina sans the water.
Right.
All kinds of stuff like that you could look at.
But I didn't, so failed.
Yeah. Something else I'd offer is if you're still really struggling with it, you're not sure of how well you're doing, when you come up with a good setting, write it down, wait a day or two, come back and look at it. And if you don't like it, critique it and try to understand why you don't like it and what you can do to fix it. Same thing with a setting in a book. If you're reading a book, be conscious of the setting. Don't just blow past it. Stop for a minute. Think, did I like that setting? Yeah, I did. How did the author do that? What is it in here I really liked about this setting? That's something that the reason The Wrinkle in Time came to mind was the first book where I really started thinking about that kind of thing was when I was reading The Wrinkle in Time. Mm-hmm. I was really dissecting how she captured some of the scenes and elements that I really liked, especially at the start of the book when she was just describing this little girl in a house. She did it so well. What about art? I have seen game masters use for their games art that either somebody else made that they just printed off and brought, or that they themselves made. I actually was in a game where all of the settings, the major settings, the game master had oil painted and then brought the oil paint. Now, they weren't super detailed oil paintings, but he kind of, you know, Bob Ross hacked them out real quick and
Bob Ross
brought them to the game as a way of illustrating the setting. Do you think art as a way to illustrate the setting is a good or bad thing?
I think it's a time-consuming thing. Well, so if it's a good thing, for me, it's a non-issue. I don't have that kind of time, and I'm not an artist. So
there's a certain amount of technical ability that's required for that.
I just can't do it.
My stick people really don't set the scene any better than me talking about it.
Have you ever gamed in a game where that was used, and do you have any opinion on it?
You know, we used to have newsprint, the paper, the cheap big pads of paper you can get at an art supply store. We would draw, it's like, okay, I go into this building, it has this kind of doorway. Well, what do you mean? Well, here, let me sketch it out real quick. You know, it wouldn't be perfect. Yeah, that kind of, it helps from a technical side. And I think it can. It really depends on the game master.
I think art is a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
Because on the one hand, what you just said, I think is exactly right. It can be used to develop a point if the just talk to description isn't clear enough. I think it can also be used as a supplement to a good description, yeah. but I have seen it used to the point of becoming a replacement for good description.
Right.
Where are you? And
well, here, let me sketch it out. Okay, everybody stop.
Yeah, you see this picture? It's just like this. The yeah. building looks just like that.
Or even
and it's
worse.
Like, well, now I'm dissecting the picture. I'm not imagining this. I'm just staring at your picture.
Yeah.
And or similar, like you come to a mountain, what does it look like? Drop an oil painting. Okay, I mean, that's kind of helpful, but yeah. could you tell me something about
well,
it?
Well, or even worse, too, and this happened to us. It's like, okay, well, I go here. Well, what does it look like? Well, it looks like blah, blah, blah. Now let me sketch it out. Everybody stops. The role-playing stops. The flow of the game stops. You watch him sketch it out.
That doesn't seem to me like that's the norm. That seems,
no, no.
That seems like an extremist position to have taken.
I think it was.
I think it could be a great crutch, or a great, not a crutch, a great supplement.
Yeah.
But... not to be used every day.
I think that in the tools of a game master, and this is something that maybe we should do in a bonus episode or something, come up with like the physical tools that a game master uses. You should always have a surface to write on that is more than a notebook, either a dry erase board
yeah.
or newsprint pad or whatever it's called. And it's just something that you could whip out and draw a picture on or make notes on. I enter a ship, and there's a shuttle to the right, and there's a doorway to the left, and there's this and that. This is your ship. Well, let's get a layout of it. That way the characters have something that they could say, oh, well, I sleep here, and I sleep there, and I run the ship from here.
The pirates attack from here.
Yeah.
Look, there's my head.
I think that that's very useful. But, yeah, I don't think that it's a good idea to rely too heavily on the art, even if you're really good at
yeah,
it.
Yeah, because you get lazy, and like I said, the players move from you to dissecting your art instead. Well, I think that's about it for setting.
Yeah.
So if you have not sent us any feedback on the show or haven't stopped by to say hi, please do so on feartheboot.com.
We'd love to see you on the forums.
And we will see you guys next time for episode 13.
See ya.
Bye.
I'm a daddy. Ugh.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot. This show is copyright 2006, fully owned by its hosts. The games, movies, and other properties mentioned in this show are the property of their respective owners. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor, as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.